9:13 on the Jefferson Exchange. Sarah Ruhl is a playwright, author, professor, MacArthur Grant recipient, and Max Ritvo was one of her students. The two developed a deep friendship and exchanged an extraordinary series of letters in the 4 years before Max's death from cancer in 2016. Their relationship comes alive in their collected letters published in the book Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. Sarah Ruhl is our guest this morning. Also this hour, we're going to hear a couple of Max poems recited for us and recorded for this broadcast by Mary Louise Parker, who is a big fan of the book. Sarah Ruhl is the author of over a dozen plays, among them Late, A Cowboy Song, Dear Elizabeth, and The Oldest Boy. Her play Dead Man's Cell Phone was produced at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival here in Ashland during its 2009 season. Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I want to just jump in here and ask you if you can describe the first moment that you met Max Ritvo.
Sure. He walked into my playwriting class at Yale when he was an undergraduate, and he just seemed like he had an ancient light bulb hovering over his head because he was so wise and he was so eloquent. And he didn't make a fuss about his own wisdom or his own eloquence. He just deeply was. And I kind of thought, who is this 21-year-old boy, and why is he so wise, and why has he seemed to have read everything? He just seemed to have a different relationship with time than his peers did. And I learned later that he had battled Ewing's sarcoma for a long time since high school. And when I met him, he was in remission.
So you hear... this is kind of almost a cliche, I guess. Now you hear these statements about people who have gone through cancer at a young age, that they seem wise beyond their years. Mm-hmm. Do you think the experience with Ewing's sarcoma added that depth to Max's character, or was it already there?
It's hard to know because I didn't know him as a child. I mean, I certainly think temperamentally, Max just is an incredibly wise person and generous person. And I've talked to his mom about what Max was like as a child, and it sounds like he always was that way, and he always was generous, and he always was friendly too, you know, made connections with people really quickly. I think the experience of having battled cancer from a young age gave Max an urgency, a desire to use his time well, and a kind of disdain for small talk and waiting. You know, he was impatient for life.
So I get the sense from the early part of your book that Max sort of appeared on the scene, not just in your class, but on the literary scene, kind of like a comet almost. And
yeah,
he got noticed very quickly, not just by you, but by other significant mm-hmm. writers. I mean, he was close to the poet Louise Gluck, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And can you describe, you know, the just sort of the general conditions that he appeared under? I mean, the whole writing scene, how did other people look at him?
Yeah, certainly I wasn't the only teacher who had a close relationship with Max. He had many teachers with whom he was incredibly close, including Louise Gluck. And he started as Louise's assistant at Yale and grew close with her. And she mentored him, you know, really beautifully throughout his time at Yale and after. And then Max went to Columbia, where he got his MFA in poetry and became close to the poet Lucy Brock Broido, who wrote a beautiful essay in The New Yorker about Max. We lost Lucy last year to cancer. But so many teachers, I feel like, recognized Max as a colleague really quickly. His teacher, Alice Quinn, is another one. And I think it was partly that Max was, I think, a genius. when you met him, you sort of went, oh, hello, colleague. You know, you couldn't completely treat him as a student. And I think the other reason that he had these extraordinary relationships with his teachers is that Max had such an acute empathy, and he didn't like to receive without giving. So, you know, he wouldn't just want you to read his manuscript without offering to read yours. He was always asking you how your life was, what you were working on. He had just this insatiable curiosity about other people. And I don't know, you know, for other people who teach at universities, the trait of having incredible empathy and interest in one's teacher's life is not a very common trait among undergraduates, certainly.
And you mentioned in the book that he very quickly became not just your student, but your teacher as well.
Yeah, I think when Max was my student at Yale, he was definitely my student, and you know, I would write things in the margins and give him ideas for revisions and give him little assignments like, what if you put that in iambic pentameter, and what if you put a song in that scene? And then at the end of the semester, he had a recurrence of his cancer, and I wanted him to know that he could come talk to me if he wanted to. I wanted to help him. I wanted to make sure he knew he had support in terms of graduating, and also just support for getting through the year. I had lost my own father to cancer when I was 20, and I was acutely aware of how hard it can be to be at college and be thinking of mortality when everyone around you is thinking about, you know, their exams. And then after Max graduated from Yale, he went to Columbia to get his MFA, and we really became friends and exchange manuscripts. He would come to a play of mine. He would send me a poem. And we really became friends. And I think it was then, as he got sicker, that was when he really became my teacher, you know, watching him battle cancer and watching him be so, so present.
We have to step in here, Sarah, yep, just for a brief break. We're talking with the playwright Sarah Rule about her student and teacher, Max Ritvo, the great poet, and we'll have a lot more to talk about after this break here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange and our discussion with Sarah Rule, the playwright, author, professor, about her new book of letters that she exchanged with Max Ritvo, a young student who 4 years later died of cancer. And so, Sarah, getting back to your earlier relationship with Max, you were and are a playwright who was kind of shy about sharing your poetry, and Max was a poet with an interest in playwriting, and so he gradually kind of wears away at your reticence, and you start sending him your poetry. You know, what happened for you in that exchange?
Well, Max was very persuasive, and if he said, come on, send me a poem, I love your poems best, I'd say, okay. You know, I didn't really think twice about it, and it was really a lovely and fruitful exchange. And ironically, Max, or I guess it's not ironic, it's fitting, but, you know, Max's friend Elizabeth Metzger, who's a wonderful poet, was the first person to publish one of my poems, you know, in any kind of grown-up way, and it was because Max had given her one of my poems. So,
did he have your permission?
Yes, he had my permission.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the poets Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop had this lifelong correspondence, and you wrote a play based on their correspondence. There's a clear parallel here between their correspondence and yours with Max. Can you kind of dive into that for us?
Yeah, well, so Bishop and Lowell sent each other, you know, over 800 letters over their lifetimes, and they were also often living in different places. Bishop was often living in South America, in Brazil, and Lowell clearly wasn't. And they became really good friends, and I think kept each other steady. I mean, Lowell had bipolar, and Bishop had problems with alcoholism. Those things don't really relate to me and Max. But I think they allowed each other in, into their solitary lives, in a really profound way. And I think, it's funny, I wrote an adaptation of their letters, and I did it at Yale, and Max was still a student there, and he came up afterwards and gave me a big hug and said, I feel like you wrote that play just for me, which was such a sweet thing to say. So I wrote that play before I met Max, but I didn't anticipate at that point that Max and I would, you know, exchange over, you know, 300 pages of letters in the time that we knew each other.
So one road that your book leads me down is a kind of a meditation on the nature of friendship. I mean, you know, Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop lived in a time when people still wrote long letters, And, you know, a long distance phone call was like a really big deal. You know, mm-hmm. it cost you a lot of money. And there was that whole process of, you know, you sit down at a typewriter or a pad of paper, you write this long letter, you take it, you put it in the mail, you put a stamp on it, et cetera. And now our friendships seem to be a lot more tenuous because they're so highly mediated by, you know, things like Facebook. And I know that a lot of your exchanges occurred by email, but, I'm wondering if you see that contradiction between the depth of your friendship and how you communicated and the way that most friendships occur now, where they just sort of are very superficial.
Definitely. I think that it's interesting that we did communicate by email, but I think the letters have the feel of letters, you know, letters that you'd send in the mail. And one example is I wrote Max this long letter after we'd had lunch one day, and it was, you know, his cancer was getting more advanced, and he told me he was afraid of death. And I wrote him a long letter about how I saw the afterlife and some dreams I'd had that comforted me about the idea of death, and I sent it to Max, and he acknowledged it. But he didn't actually respond to that letter until a year later, and he wrote me a beautiful long response. And he needed to wait to answer that letter until he'd fully processed it, but also I think he wasn't ready to accept his mortality at the point when I'd written him the letter. And when he answered, I think he was. So, I mean, how often do we wait in our communications with people a year before, you know, deeply answering back? And I think in our media crazed world, you have to answer back within minutes. You almost have to answer back while there's no time for a response.
If you don't, somebody says, "Hey, did you get my email?"
Right, exactly. And I think there's something about time and duration that changes our feelings and reflections about things. So that even just the waiting for a letter in the mail, you know, we might feel differently about a thing if we have to wait for the letter and then know that our response will take a while to get there. Time mediates the relation, and we don't have that luxury in our friendships anymore.
Another, to me, fascinating aspect of this book is the, you know, the differences. I'm going to ask you to read something here for us, if you don't mind. And it's the excerpt on page 104 of your book. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of differences that came just in terms of age and background between you and Max and how that got bridged. Could you read those two paragraphs for us, please?
Yeah. So I say, perhaps it's worth mentioning that I come from a people, Midwestern, Catholic, Lutheran, Scandinavian, Irish, and white, who are not traditionally demonstrative, loving absolutely, but demonstrations of love more subtle. When my father was diagnosed with cancer when I was 18, we all had to learn to say, "I love you," when we got off the phone. This felt odd at first, a muffled bird in the throat, but we got used to it. After my father died, my mother and sister and I continued to say the words to each other, but my family is Midwestern tribal, no "I love yous" to non-blood relatives. Max was quite the opposite. If he loves you, he told you, even if he'd only recently met you, volubly, often, and sincerely.
And so did Max kind of break down some of that Midwestern quality that you have? I should say I'm from the Midwest too, so I fully understand what you're saying.
Yeah. Yes, I think he did. I mean, I think the passage that I read from follows a little scene where I talk about Max reading me a poem in a cafe in Brooklyn, and he said, I would like to read you a poem, and he said, "Stand and receive it." And I was like, oh my God, I was so mortified on some level. And then he read it in this big booming voice. And funnily enough, there was a playwright who I knew in the cafe too at the time, who I ran into recently, who remembered the scene with great tenderness. And I remember afterwards we were walking out the door, and I said, "Oh my God, Max, I love the poem," and I was so embarrassed. And he was so apologetic, saying, "Oh my God, I embarrassed you. Oh, I'm so sorry." He felt terrible, and I said, "No, it's all right. Not embarrassed in a bad way. Just in the way that Elizabeth Bishop was embarrassed when she read a poem that she really liked, where she said, I don't want to look at it directly. So I do think Max taught me a lot about the value of being demonstrative. And when he performed his poetry too, he was not retiring about it. He was a performer. He would wear a pink kimono and he would stand and he would read in a booming voice. Sometimes I remember on one occasion he was spinning while he read or slowly rotating because there were people, it was so packed, there were people on stage with him. So I temperamentally will never be like Max. You know, we are the way we are to some extent. But he really showed me the value of being demonstrative, and sometimes ignoring certain codes of politeness when you want to get through to someone.
And of course, throughout the book, there's always the cancer. It's always in the background, and sometimes it comes very very quickly and sort of brutally into the foreground. There are times that Max writes about his cancer that just, you know, kind of stopped me cold. One line really stuck with me where he says, I'm bitter, I love the world, and it won't love me back.
Ugh, I know, I love that line, and it's so devastating.
So, you know, these are kind of, hurts to read a lot of these descriptions of his treatments. I mean, they were just constant, ongoing, you know, I'm going to Israel for an experimental treatment, and now I'm at Sloan Kettering, and now I'm in L.A., and I'm getting chemotherapy, and I'm getting radiation, and it's just unbelievable. How did he do it?
He just did it, you know? I mean, he just moved forward. He was always moving forward. He was always moving forward and joking about moving forward. He was always being generous, being joyful. I remember one time he wrote a little note to one of the doctors who had just performed surgery on him near the holiday of Yom Kippur. Max was raised Jewish, and he wrote a note saying, thank you so much for getting me out of services. like he was hilarious with his doctors, with his friends. I feel like everywhere he went, he left a little trail of Maxness behind.
We're talking this morning on the Jefferson Exchange with playwright Sarah Rule, who, along with Max Ritvo, wrote a book and collected their letters. It's called Letters from Max, a Book of Friendship. Sarah, at what point did you and Max decide that your letters were going to be a project in and of themselves, that you might collect them into a book?
I think about 2 years into writing to each other. We had written so many letters back and forth, and partly I thought it would be fun to just do a writing project with Max just because it would be fun and interesting. And partly I thought it might be a project to distract him from chemotherapy and everything he was going through. And partly I was well aware that he might die, and I wanted there to be more of his prose in the world. And I was anxious to preserve his legacy.
And so you mentioned that this project, you know, could serve as a distraction. And I noticed there are several exchanges where, like, there's one point where I think he's actually getting chemotherapy and you're sending him these, like, I think there were texts where it's like, which Bronte sister do you like better? So was literature kind of a distraction? Did it help Max get his mind off the real horrors that his body was suffering?
Yeah, absolutely. And we were always exchanging books, and I would send him Job Ace, and, you know, he would send me William James. You know, we were always going back and forth about reading, and at first I thought our collection of letters might be just a little handmade, you know, done up with string kind of thing we would circulate to friends, just a gift. And then also Max started getting really known for his work. He had a chapbook published, he won a big prize, he was having another book published, and it became clear that a little handmade book didn't really make sense, and that it was a book. And I think it was then we went to Max's publisher, Milkweed, that published Max's really extraordinary first book of poetry called Four Reincarnations, and came to them with the idea of doing a book of letters.
Sarah Rule is our guest this morning, talking about letters that she wrote and exchanged with Max Ritvo. Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. You can join the conversation this morning by calling us at 800-838-3760 or send us an email, jx@jeffnat.org. Perhaps you're a fan of Max's poetry or of Sarah's plays and would like to join the conversation. Again, 800-838-3760. Or jx@jeffnat.org. Sarah, you know, some of the, for me anyway, the most moving moments in your letters just juxtapose this, you know, this immensity of, you know, mortality and your conversations about spirituality with Max, with these very sort of mundane moments in time, and they're really kind of tender. And I'm wondering if, you know, before our break, you could read one of those for us. It's the one where you and Max are just hanging out with your husband and children. Mm,
sure. So this was from a visit to California. Summers often have me visiting my in-laws in Los Angeles. On my family trip to California that summer, we all went to have sushi in the valley. My husband, Tony, my three kids, Max, and me. Max joked that the only way to get him to drive to the valley was to see my family. My oldest daughter, Anna, who was about 7 at the time, adored Max. Children were drawn to Max because he was playful and empathetic and didn't care about grown-up social mores. At lunch, Max looked very skinny, frightened. We did not go to a Ferris wheel. It seemed like too much. I remember that summer my twins were 3 years old. It was the summer they learned to swim.
Yeah, that last line really hit me. It was the summer they learned to swim, because it's this very sort of specific moment in time for you, and yet, you know, you constantly have that knowledge that Max doesn't have a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you want me to, I can read the poem that the idea of swimming came into.
Please
from
do.
The next page. Okay, this is called For Max with Thanks to Maury Sendak. Death no wild thing, and you a boy, Max. One night in your room or body a forest grew, and the walls or cells became transparent, because brightness invites transparency, I guess. Then a little boat to hospital smells. Doctors called the forest cancer, not obscuring leaves, and you a boy. You say, why can't people use the word courage instead of something vulgar and idiomatic about manhood? Courage, I say, is you, Max, in your wild suit, your small boat, and terrible forest. A man overnight, no boy could ever scale those walls. You come home and dinner is waiting, still waiting, I hope, still warm. And today my small boy learned to swim. He said the water held me, Mama. It held me.
Wow, it's, you know, it's extraordinary how Maury Sendak's book continues to resonate for so many people. And his, did he identify with Max from Where the Wild Things Are?
You know, I don't know. I bizarrely have never asked Max that question. I'll have to ask his mom.
So,
but yeah, that book is so iconic. I mean, there's so much crazy Jungian, you know, stuff going on there.
Yeah, I think, I don't know anybody who doesn't have that book on their shelf.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I also remember another point, just to kind of continue on this vein of discussion, where you just are talking to Max and you said, wait a minute, I have to go wipe one of my kids' noses. did you ever find it uncomfortable to be talking about those just very ordinary moments of life when they're juxtaposed against, you know, what he was dealing with? Did that ever kind of come up between the two of you?
Didn't. And it was one of the amazing things about Max. He cared equally about the ordinary trivia of life and his friend's life, and as he did about all the looming big questions he was dealing with. I think those little things actually were precious to Max because they were the stuff of life, and they distracted him from all the looming big questions. And I think one thing that amazed me about Max always was his ability to toggle back and forth between subjects some might find trivial, like he would just get really into it about like Cyndi Lauper or whatever band he loved, and then he would suddenly be moving to David Hume and Freud and concepts of the afterlife and concepts of what's the difference between a religion you're born into versus a religion you chose for yourself later. I think he said at some point, I consider that anything could is fit to be the spiritual centerpiece of a poem. And I think it had to do with his attitude that there's reverence for the daily, there's reverence for the small, and there's reverence for, you know, what we consider historically to be the large, big topics.
Not all of us can jump from Cyndi Lauper to Carl Jung very easily. Sarah Rule is our guest this morning, and playwright, MacArthur Fellowship recipient, and her new book, along with the poet Max Ritvo, is called Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. We'll be back with more of our discussion and actually hear some of Max's poetry recited by Mary Louise Parker as we continue with the Jefferson Exchange after this break. Nine 40 in the final segment here on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're talking with Sarah Rule, who, along with the poet Max Ritvo, have just published the book Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. And we've been talking for 40 minutes or so about Max's poetry, but we haven't really heard any, and so let's remedy that situation right now.
Hospice. My head is a bed on fire. You leave the bed and leave me without thought. The springs want to embrace each other, but they're afraid if they break their spiral, they will never be able to hold anyone. I wish you would let me know how difficult it is to love me. Then I would know you love me beneath all that difficulty. You are tending not only to me, you tell me, but to your other child, Air. An air puts his feet in my slippers. An air scrubs his teeth on my brush. And wherever my demands are not, there are his. And we must learn to share a bed. We must learn to share a body. The money is running low. We will have to split one needle this winter. One end for me, one end for Air.
That was Mary Louise Parker, who read that poem by Max Ritvo for us. And from my understanding, is she just read them into a cell phone and sent them to us. That's really wonderful, and kind of fits the way that you and Max exchanged emails and texts and letters for this book. Sarah, can you characterize Max's poetry? I mean, there's a point in the book where you say, he's transparent, but the prevailing literary stance in poetry is opacity. Can you explain that for us?
Well, I think, I mean, the opacity question came up once because Max went to some reading of an acquaintance, and afterwards he said, "Oh, I really loved your poem, but there was something I didn't get, or you know, some meaning was lost on him." And she said, "That's okay. I don't want you to get it." And he kind of went, "Oh." And I said, you know what? Resist opacity, Max. You know, this is when he was still my student. And I think the opacity in some academic poetry circles these days, and maybe it's changing now, but certainly when I went to Brown, when I was Max's age, there was a privileging of a certain kind of opacity, and I felt like if you were transparent about emotion, it was like a little bit embarrassing in those circles. And I tend to gravitate towards poetry that is more in the ancient tradition of lyric poetry, where there can be emotional restraint, but not you're not actually trying to cover your tracks. It's really trying to cover your tracks in some academic poetry circles that I think really makes people feel outside of poetry, and makes it a kind of elite art form that people aren't invited into. So that's a long rant for me, but I felt like Max's poetry, and I feel like Max's poetry really invites the reader in the same way that Max did as a person, you know, really invites you into his emotional life, into the specificity of the body, and into his humor too. I mean, one remarkable thing I think about his poetry is he'll be going along in this kind of beautiful, you know, lyric way, and then there'll just be a joke that stops you and turns left that you're not expecting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to zoom out too far from our discussion here, but what you said about poetry and it's sort of kind of become housed in the academy in the last several generations, and a lot of music has as well, and there is that sort of quality of you don't understand this, you're not in the in group, and poetry seems to be sort of lost from the public eye, because I mean, isn't it true that a best-selling book of poems would be if you sold 2,000 copies or something like that?
Yeah, I don't know the specifics, but that seems about right. And I also think there's a slight turning up of the nose in the Academy of poets who do sell a lot of books. that's not the goal. So, poets who I think are beloved more from a general audience, like Mary Oliver, I think there are poets in the Academy who would kind of roll their eyes at that. And I get that we need universities as kind of our de Medicis now, to be patrons of the arts, but I think it can get a little bit incestuous. And in a funny way, it protects your job as a poet if no one can understand your poetry.
You just go to a department meeting and say, "Well, just keep trying. Eventually you'll get it." I want to ask you about time and the structure of these letters with Max. And I have to confess here that you mentioned earlier in the interview about a letter that you include, and then it took Max an entire year to reply to that letter. And I have to confess that I skipped forward in the book at that point
and
looked for the other letter. But in your afterword to the book, you describe about how you and Max wrestled with how to order the letters, whether you would do it chronologically or otherwise, and you opted for, or maybe just surrendered reluctantly to a chronological listing, or not listing, but a collection of the letters. Why did you do that?
I did it because I felt like there was a story of an evolving friendship that has a beginning, middle, and hopefully no end in a way. And that if we had ordered them by subject matter, it made the letters a little bit more abstract, and in fact a little more academic. But that what part of the emotional power is of two people writing back and forth over time is watching a relationship develop, and you only get that if you have a beginning, middle, and end. And I think I was reflecting or surmising that Max might have resisted a chronological approach while he was alive because it implied an ending that he wasn't there to witness. And that, so I took my time trying to find the structure because I knew that when Max was alive, it was not his favorite approach. But I also knew that when he was alive, we tried several structures that didn't quite work. So I did the best I could, and sometimes it's like that Occam's razor's idea that the simplest solution is the best, and chronology is one of those simple solutions.
So can we talk about the last days of Max's life? I mean, there were some very poignant moments, of course, but also some funny ones, like when his phone's autocorrect function kept changing the word die to did. Can you describe those days for you?
Yeah. I mean, I was privileged enough to be in L.A. and to see Max a number of times before he died that July. My work had brought me there, and also, as I said, we visit relatives in L.A. in the summer. So sometimes I would just sit with Max. I mean, sometimes he was on morphine, and he was kind of in and out of the conversation, but then he would always come in with something funny and totally on point. And so I did get to say goodbye to him, and I remember clearly standing in his kitchen saying goodbye, and he had this little, he couldn't walk very well at that point, so he had, between his bedroom on the second floor and the first floor, there was this little, machine that would take you up the stairs, this little automatic seat, and I remember Max sitting in that little automatic seat and waving goodbye to him, and that was the last time I saw him. And we were in touch after that, but
I think we might have lost Sarah. I think what we're going to do right now is just to do a summary of where we're at, and our engineers trying to get Sarah back on the phone. That was a rather poignant moment to have lost that call. We've been talking with Sarah Ruhl and Max Ritvo about Letters from Max, a book of friendship, and letters collected over the course of the four-year friendship that she had with the late poet Max Ritvo. And I think we're going to have Sarah back on the phone here. Sarah, are you back with us?
Do you think that's something that, what are the chances that we would get cut off right as I was talking about
I actually just mentioned that to our listeners. That was that was pretty scary, actually.
I feel it was Max having a joke on us, actually, and saying hello, to be honest.
Well, thank you, Max. That was, he certainly knows how to terrorize a radio host. we were talking about the last moments of Max's life, but and we are kind of running to the end of our interview here, and I do want to get in one final poem of Max's and have you comment on it. So here it is. Great.
Quiet romance. I am too weak for sexual urges anymore, but I yearn to be naked all the time. I want to urinate without having to pull off underpants. The world wants me to know it's okay to slip into and out of her. She likes it. When I die, make sure Dad doesn't screw a hat on me to keep the brains in. And let nobody put a shirt on me. Let Death put her cool head on my stomach for a listen. I want every hole naked, the pupils, nostrils, the tube below my gut. I want to listen back. I can hear already a roaring in the distance, half salt, half horse. I like this. I'm scared, but so's the sound. We'll both be guests.
That book, or that poem rather, by Max Ritvo was read by Mary Louise Parker. Sarah, how do you react to that poem?
Oh, I just think it's a masterpiece. I mean, I don't know exactly what there is to say about it, but I was talking a little bit about the body and how Max insisted on it, and that there's an eroticism in the poem, a sensuality about the body, even with what he's going through, you know, even with this, the body failing him, this incredible vision of there not being any separation between his body and the air. I just think it's exquisite, and just so that listeners know, that poem is included in my book, or our book, Letters from Max, because Max sent it to me, but it's also in The Final Voicemails, which is a collection that Louise Gluck edited after Max's death, and is an extraordinary book of mostly his last poems.
So what do you want listeners to know about Max? I mean, I'm putting you on the spot here, but can you describe the essence of this young man?
The essence of Max really was love. He was such a loving person, so loving to his friends and family, to his wife. He got married in the last year before he died. And love for writing, love for literature, love for art. And I think that's partly why his poems resonate so deeply, is there's so much love in them, so much playfulness, so much wisdom, but at the end, so much love.
And this book, Letters from Max, a book of friendship, we had these poems read for us by Mary Louise Parker. Before we go, I just wanted to mention her role in this. You know, she showed up and they said, hey, Mary Louise Parker will read some poems for you. I said, well, okay. But she has a nice quote on the jacket. Is she a big fan of the book?
Yeah, I mean, she was so incredibly supportive of the book. She's a friend of mine, and I love her as an actress, but also as a writer. And so she gave us the sweetest blurb on the front of the book. But also, I mean, I think I had given her some of Max's poetry to read, and she loved it so much. And she was just enraged that she'd never met Max because she loved his poetry so much.
And will Max show up in your future work, Sarah?
You know, I think he's already there. I think he's there in plays like The Oldest Boy. And there's a part of me that wonders if there isn't maybe a play in Letters from Max, because as I've been doing some readings of the book, I often read with a friend so that Max's voice is represented. So I'm sure Max will continue to show up.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to that. And perhaps if there is a play of Letters from Max, we can all attend the performances of that at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
I love that place so much. You live in the most beautiful part of the country.
The book is Letters from Max, a book of friendship, an extraordinary collection of letters, really moving. And it's by Sarah Rule and Max Ritvo. Sarah, thank you so much for spending the time with us this morning on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.